This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, you know what? The best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word, and then take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I talked with Osmo Venska recently. He spent 19 years at the helm of the Minnesota Orchestra, and in June of 2022, his final concerts were of the Symphony No. 8 by Gustav Mahler. Now, this Mahler cycle was really one of Osmo's bucket list items, he said. He was so excited to be able to record all of Mahler's symphonies while he was working with the Minnesota Orchestra. This is not the final recording in the series. That'll be the third symphony, which will probably come out before the summertime. We're going to be learning about this recording. It's the Symphony No. 8, the Symphony of a Thousand. And it was recorded at the tail end of the worst of the global pandemic, so there were a lot of challenges to face, including the fact that one of their important soloists came down with COVID. So they had to come up with a last-minute plan, which really saved the recording. You're going to be finding out about that and much more as we learn from Osmo Venska what it took to bring together the Symphony No. 8 by Gustav Mahler. This week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, I'm Julie Amacher. So I'm talking with Osmo Venska, the conductor laureate of the Minnesota Orchestra, and they have just recently released their Symphony No. 8, the Symphony of a Thousand by Gustav Mahler as part of the Mahler cycle. Welcome, Osmo.
Thank you very much, Julie.
So you closed out your tenure as the music director with the Minnesota Orchestra after 19 years in June of 2022, and you did so with a very grand gesture. And it's now been preserved on this new recording that was recently released. And this has been a multi-year project. So now we're thinking about this Symphony No. 8. You have a copy that you brought in, and you have it in your possession. Have you listened to it? How do you feel about it right now as you think about it?
I haven't listened to the actual CD. But what I have listened to is the first edit, and I think the second edit, and I have said my words about what needs to be changed. Maybe this we have a better take for these bars and so on. That kind of listening I have done. But when it finally came out, I haven't listened to it. And that happens with all my recordings. It's the process when everything is recorded and editing is needed. Then I hear very carefully and I listen to it very carefully. Then it's like done in my mind when it's ready for the public.
And you can move forward to the final recording in this cycle.
Exactly, yeah.
Which has yet to be released and probably will be released later this year, it sounds
yeah,
like, the
Mahler
Symphony No. 3.
Yeah.
So this recording is made up of the largest scale performances ever conducted at Orchestra Hall. Is that true?
I think it is true.
And you also did this with four choirs, several soloists, the full orchestra, and that would be a massive project at any time. This is not a work that's often recorded or performed for that reason. And you were doing it on the heels of the global pandemic. Tell me what kind of challenges you faced under those circumstances.
Well, we had a meeting some weeks before the recording with the choir conductors, and we had to make a decision what is the way to do this so that we are not taking too many risks and we still can do the recording. And we decided on the meeting that all the choir members, they are going to use the mask, because they are singing behind the orchestra and it's too much of a risk if they are singing without the mask. So that was the first thing. And then we also located the soloists between the string section and the audience. So they had a chance not to use a mask because there is distance enough for the audience. And in rehearsals, we took care that the soloists are not turning and singing to the orchestra as is usually the case in rehearsals. It helps both ways when they can see and hear the orchestra as well as the musicians too. But that was forbidden, no turning. And well, one thing more. After the first rehearsal, we had a plan to test after every rehearsal if something is going to happen so that we are not going to lose like a lot of things. So after the first rehearsal, I think that we had like two or three players, and then one of the soloists tested positive. And that was a problem because during that time it was really difficult to get anyone into the country from outside US. Everybody needed special arrangements for that. And then Caroline Sampson, the British great soprano, who was supposed to do only this short angel part singing from the third balcony. We asked her after it was obvious that we don't get anyone from outside, and Caroline said, "I have never done it, but I'm ready to try." And then she came to the second rehearsal like doing everything as she has done many, many times. So that was the first time, and we all were like, oh, "Yeah, thank you, Caroline. She saved this production." So in a concert, she went out of the stage, but didn't go upstairs to do the short part, and then came back to stage. And yes, that's why we have one soloist less than in usual recordings. I think we have eight soloists, and usually there are nine.
One of the things that I heard Kathy Stoltzman-Romey say, who was leading the choirs, was it was almost like training for a marathon, especially because a lot of the singers hadn't been singing during COVID.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that rehearsal process and how everybody got into shape, basically, to do this big production?
I think that for me, it was very much like a normal thing. Because we had the same amount, I had the same amount of time with the choir. Kathy did more with them, and so I'm sure that she felt more about that. But we knew that the singers are going to have a mask, so the most important thing was how to pronounce so that we can hear all the text which is coming out. And I think that from my side, that was a big challenge. And also to get enough volume and made the singers feel comfortable, because it's obvious if you have a mask, it's difficult to sing out. But that's what happened. They really, the choirs sang out everything, and it just sounded great. And I know that on the recording also, and the text is available there, just with listening, and it all went well. But there were many challenges which we had to take, and Kathy had to take care before the first orchestra rehearsal.
You're talking about the text, and it was actually, you know, two works with text that inspired Mahler. Can you tell us about that so that we can have a greater understanding of what this work is about?
Well, I think that it was some sort of idea. Mahler was using a text which is maybe his way to understand how to go to heaven and what needs to be done. And the second half has a different text from Faust. It's some sort of arrangement by Mahler to make his message clear for the listeners. This was number 8 of his symphonies. And then ninth was like he was writing about the dead and how it's going, he feels that it's going to happen to him. The last moment of the ninth symphony is just like someone is dying, beautiful but long process. And then he started to do sketches for the symphony number 10. So it's easy to think about that the eighth symphony, this which we are speaking about now, was also full of those things, which what is going to happen for me, what is going to happen to us when we are going to die? Is there something after death or not? That is the big theme on those texts.
So here you are. It's the final week or so of your tenure, your official tenure with the Minnesota Orchestra, and you're about to lead this Symphony of 1,000. It's named for that, I believe, because of how many people are on stage, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, the number is a little bit too high, but the world premiere happened in a place which was not totally outdoor place, but some sort of outdoor place, and they needed a lot of forces to make the sound so that it was good for Mahler and to make this work sounding as he wrote. But so I think we had something like 350 people, maybe 400 on stage.
Still, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of microphones to set up for a recording.
Oh, yeah.
And it all came together. And you are now at the center of it, leading it. Tell me what was going through your mind when you got up to the podium for the first time for that first performance, because this recording is made up of several of those performances that week and then a few patch sessions. But what was going through your mind and what were you thinking about? Like, I mean, it was an intense process, an intense week.
Yeah. I think that I try to keep in my mind that my duty is to make music. My duty is not to think about how many microphones there are, not to think about the recording, not to think anything else than music, trying to go to the music and breathe it. And I think it's right to say that job was to play the orchestra and the choirs. It's like a huge instrument, and my job is to try to make it sounding as Mahler wrote it. So, of course, a lot of concentration and all kind of things which I need to do before every concert. I don't want to say that all concerts are exactly the same. There are even more important concerts than some others, but I cannot think too much about that. I actually learned many things during my 6 years with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, which plays in Glasgow. Whatever we played, always when we performed, BBC microphones were there. And that was my time to understand that why I cannot concentrate, especially for the radio broadcasting concerts. No, every time the microphones are there, and my job is to do as well as possible. So this has been some sort of like a bigger line after those years in Scotland. And the same thing here. We need to do as well as possible. And then when those concerts were done, then everything came from Rob Saff, who was a producer, artistic director of BIS, because then he had all the materials. And it was his job to tell us what is needed now. So in a way, I am one part of the big organization on that time, and if we all are doing our job well enough, then the final recording is going to be good, and I think that happens. And I have to say right now, I have done I don't know how many 50 60 CDs with Rob Saff, and he is just the simple way to put it, he's the best producer in the world. I He's just amazing how well he hears things and how well he knows what is needed, what is making this music better. And he always have understood my interpretation. So he's not trying to make something else there. He understands how to make my musical thoughts coming so that they are good and they are at the highest level.
When you approach Mahler, and in particular this symphony, what are some of the musical thoughts that are going through your mind, things you really want to focus on?
Well, I think that especially with this piece, because it's so large and long and so many people are on stage, I listened to old recordings and some newer too. But I think that I heard maybe 20 different recordings of this piece, trying to understand how things have been put together, what kind of tempos are the conductors using, how the soloists are singing. And that was like a preparation which took a lot of time. And then the goal was that when I go to the first orchestra rehearsal, then I know exactly how things are going. And I sent to the choirs, to orchestra members also, like a list of tempo metronome markings in different movements so that people had an idea what my thoughts are going to be. Because piece like that, we don't have enough time to rehearse every single note there. People are doing their homework, singers and players. And that's why it was important for them to know at least some sort of idea where we are going to go. And it still leaves some freedom for the concert. I can go how my breathing is asking me to do. But it was a big job to prepare for this piece.
I was thinking about the premiere of this work that Mahler conducted, and he didn't feel like they had enough prep time. He wanted to bail on the whole thing, but he didn't. Do you know how it turned out? Did it turn out as he had hoped?
No one knows, because we don't have any documents from that. But the music of Gustav Mahler is always very complicated. He knows how to write for the orchestra, and he's using like millions of important details. So it's not news that Mahler felt that he didn't have enough time to have practiced and rehearsed all the things. It's that long piece that you need to have. If you need to do everything, you need 2 weeks for the rehearsals, but that is not a very practical idea.
So I'm trying to think about the emotional context of this for you, as this was, you wrapping up your official tenure with the orchestra with this massive work. At what point during the performance did you have a moment where it was like, oh my gosh, this is happening?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I cannot give you a very good answer. I just remember that I think we had three concerts, and every time when it went, I just felt that things are going well, and things are those a few bars which are really difficult because the tempo is changing, and they have to click together. Those things went well in all three concerts, and so that gives good self-confidence that, okay, we are doing well and so on. But it's if you want to ask me, did I feel that this is my last concert of the 19 years old or a job at Minnesota Orchestra? No, I didn't think about that. Every concert is important, as I have tried to explain. And I think that this, speaking about this Mahler 8, it's just so difficult piece. It's really difficult, complicated to keep together. And when you concentrate for music and keeping this music going and holding back and going when needed, that gives this kind of feeling that we are, the satisfaction comes that way. I don't need to think about it. That is my last concert or last week. Those feelings came much later. But I have to add, of course, that is a great way to do the last concert. So I think that the conductor cannot ask anything more than to have this huge piece with huge number of singers and players and good music which comes out from that music when things are going well. Of course, that is like I don't know, is it a marathon or is it how to call it? But emotionally, yes, if we can do that, then it's done. That has been there, but that is the closest. I didn't think about what I'm going to do next Monday.
Yeah, you're very present in the moment, which is not always easy to do. I want to, as I put this feature together, this interview together, I'll be including little excerpts of the music to emphasize what you're talking about. And what I would really love to do is to have you give me a few of the points within this symphony that you really want us to listen for, that just always, you know, every time you conducted it or heard it, you were like, yes, this is one of those points where I want to make sure people don't miss this. Can you identify a few of those for me, and why are those important?
I would like to say that when you start, for example, the very beginning of the whole symphony. I would like to give a special thanks to Tore Brinkmann, who was the sound engineer for this project, because when we are speaking about the CD, I don't know how many microphones they used in this piece, a lot, and then the guy who is handling the sound should be like really, really super good to get the right sound there. They can do things later on, but everything must be there in right sound color and right distance and so on. So Ture was really a hero when he did his job and the sound booth with Robert Saff, who was a producer. So my biggest thanks to those guys with whom I have been working many times, and the BIS company, they are well known about their high quality work, and I want you to mention that when people are listening to this piece, you cannot hear what you are hearing if those two guys didn't do excellent job.
So what about as you are conducting this piece live in Orchestra Hall, and are there a couple of points within this work that you always look forward to? Like, you did sort of hint, like, ooh, there's a couple of places where that went well, good, now that built my confidence. Can you identify those so we can share those little sections as we're sharing
them? I think that
them?
There are too many of those points to make them, like, separately. But I think it's not only for me, for all of us, how to make a balance with those like hugely loud things which are coming, so that the timing for them is right. And then to go to the other side, those when maybe one of the soloists is singing. Or the orchestra is playing without any soloist. Thank you. so that we have this kind of the emotionally softest things there, where you almost cannot breathe at all, and then comes this kind of building up moment, and when you have to go, and when it comes to the point that this kind of biggest forte and emotions are coming like naturally together, and then Mahler just goes immediately away from that and somewhere else. So it's those kind of things. Sometimes you have to think, as a conductor, you have to think about that. We start now one thing, especially in the very end of the whole piece, like the slowest possible tempo. And next 4 minutes or 5 minutes is going to be like increasing things, emotionally increasing things, like louder increasing things with the tempo. And then it finally it should come like a climbing up without accidents, and then you are there, and you can see on the top of the mountain, you can see the huge vision what is there waiting for you. And if you don't make that like organic, natural way, then the vision is not going to be good enough.
If you could sit down with Mahler over a cup of coffee or whatever your favorite beverage is, what would you ask him?
I would like to ask, how is it possible that you made these huge symphonies, and has been said that you did those composing thing only during your summer vacation time? How is it possible?
What do you think he might say?
Well, I don't know, but he was a genius composer, as he was a genius conductor. As a conductor, I have always to remember when I am preparing Mahler's music, that he was one of the best conductors on his time, and he was one of the best composers. And I think that the composer Mahler asked many times conductor Mahler, what is the right way to orchestrate this, that it's easy to play, and then conductor Mahler was happy when the composer Mahler did things. So it's so well written. It's so well written for different instruments. It always sounds natural. He knew exactly all the instruments, how they were working. That is like really a great point of his personality, that they were both of them. Then there was a husband too, and very, very disappointed husband, and the love life of the family is there are books about that. But when I have been asked about what happened in the family and their relationship, I think that that's one reason why we love Mahler's music. It wasn't only about Gustav and Alma. It was about all of us. There are relationships and there are broken relationships every week, every day in the world. And what Mahler wrote about their situation is exactly the same what happens for ordinary people all over the world. And I think that that's the key, why we love that music, because it's giving so many emotions for us about those usual things which the life has in it.
The penultimate recording in the Mahler cycle with the Minnesota Orchestra and Osmovenska and a number of soloists, including four choirs. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, she's our producer for New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.